A recent TED Talk explored what lifestyle choices might enable a person to live to be 100 years old. Developmental psychologist Susan Pinker studied the residents of a small village on the island of Sardinia, where there are 6 times as many centenarians as on the Italian mainland, with less than 200 miles away. And there are 10 times as many centenarians as there are in North America. It's the only place where men live as long as women. You're all going to move to Sardinia now, aren't you? Dr. Pinker then explored brain activity related to her findings and followed a different study by a researcher in Utah. And this is what she said about living a long life. Okay, so clean air, which is great, it doesn't predict how long you will live. Whether your hypertension is treated is good, still not a strong predictor. Whether you're lean or overweight, you can stop feeling guilty about this because it's only third from the bottom. How much exercise you get is next, but still only a moderate predictor. Whether you've had a cardiac event and you're in rehab and exercising, getting a little bit higher now. Whether you've had a flu vaccine. Did anybody here know that having a flu vaccine protects you more than doing exercise? Whether you were drinking and quit, or whether you're a moderate drinker. Whether you smoke, or if you did, whether you quit. And getting towards the top predictors are two features about social life. First, your close relationships. These are people that you can call on for a loan if you need money suddenly, who will call the doctor if you're not feeling well, or who will take you to the hospital, or who will sit with you if you're having an existential crisis, if you're in despair. Those people, that little clutch of people, are a strong predictor, if you have them, of how long you'll live. And then something surprised me, something that's called social integration. This means how much you interact with people as you move through your day. How many people do you talk to? And these mean both your weak and your strong bonds. So not just the people you're really close to who mean a lot to you, but like, do you talk to the guy who every day makes you your coffee? Do you talk to the postman? Do you talk to the woman who walks by your house every day with her dog? Do you play bridge or poker or have a book club? Those interactions are one of the strongest predictors of how long you'll live. Well, as the pastor of a church where there is a lot of social interaction, I find this pretty interesting. And as a Christian who strives to follow Jesus, who is rather big on community, I find this encouraging. But I'm not actually sure I want to live to be 100. There's a lot that depends on that. But I still think that the findings shared in this TED Talk correlate with what we're trying to do as a church. So I looked to see if there was any research done on whether going to church makes a difference in one's health. You know I found a study that would prove that, right? A recent study at Vanderbilt University, very well reputed place, a recent study at Vanderbilt University concluded that attending worship services is beneficial. So give yourselves a hand. Yay! Researchers analyzed subjects' attendance at worship services, their mortality, and something some of you will understand, their allostatic load. Allostatic load is a physiological measurement of factors including cardiovascular, nutritional, inflammatory, and metabolic measures. The higher the allostatic load, the more stressed an individual was interpreted to be. Of the 5,449 people of all races and both sexes who were surveyed, 64% were regular worshipers. Non-worshippers had a significantly higher overall allostatic load scores than did churchgoers and other worshipers. The effect of attendance at worship services remained after education, poverty, health insurance, and social support status were all taken into consideration. The study did not address the frequency of worship. So if we don't see any of you next week, we'll know why. The researcher, Dr. Bruce, concluded, "We found that these people go to church for factors beyond social support. That's where we begin to think about this idea of compassionate thinking, that we're trying to improve the lives of others as well as being connected to a body larger than ourselves. Now, let me be clear that I don't think Jesus came so that we would live longer or have perfect BMI, cholesterol, and blood sugar scores. Faith is bigger than that. You might say that Jesus came to save us. But in his day, in the world in which the New Testament was written, being saved meant being healed. And being healed had to do with the body, mind, and spirit. I do think it's fair to say that God desires our well-being. In Jesus' day, if people were sick with a fever or a hemorrhage of blood, or if they were behaving strangely and presumed to be possessed by a demon, they were shunned by the community and they kept themselves away. To be healed, to have the fever or the demon leave, meant that they could be restored to the community. In today's lesson, Peter's mother-in-law has a fever. She is alone at home until Peter brings Jesus and a few others to heal her. She is healed and cured, and she immediately rejoins the community and enacts the community by providing food and hospitality to those who made her well. And then the word gets out and the proverbial floodgates open, and Jesus is surrounded by those who need healing. It's no wonder he goes off to pray by himself. We might say that his resources are depleted and he needs to recharge his batteries. We might say that he needs to reconnect with the source of his healing, his God. Lutheran pastor David Loos asked some good questions about this story. He says, what did the man with the unclean spirit, who was cast out a week ago in last week's story, do after his healing? And what did all the people Jesus heals in this week's story do once they were freed from the various ailments of mind, body, and spirit that had captivated them? Some, I imagine, were simply so grateful to be made well. So grateful, that is, that they had been freed from something debilitating and destructive, that they returned as quickly as possible to their old lives and routines and relationships. But some, I'm willing to bet, including Simon's mother-in-law, recognized that they were not only freed from something, they were also freed for something, for lives of purpose and meaning and service and generosity and more. So let me ask a different question. If you live to be 100, what will your life look like? When you die, will people look at your life and have a sense that something bigger than you impacted your choices? That your commitment to an ideal or an ethic or to faith shaped how you lived? A few years ago, New York Times columnist David Brooks wrote a piece about the difference between what he calls resume virtues and eulogy virtues. He writes, about once a month, I run across a person who radiates an inner light. These people can be in any walk of life. They seem deeply good. They listen well. They make you feel funny and valued. You often catch them looking after other people, and as they do so, their laugh is musical, and their manner is infused with gratitude. They are not thinking about what wonderful work they are doing. They are not thinking about themselves at all. When I meet such a person, it brightens my whole day. But I confess I often have a sadder thought. It occurs to me that I've achieved a decent level of career success, but I have not achieved that. I have not achieved that generosity of spirit or that depth of character. What good is living to 100 if that long life is filled with self-service? What good is being healed if the one who is better does not in some way offer healing to someone else? At last week's meeting of the Interfaith Alliance on Poverty, Multnomah County Chair Deborah Cafori shared her reflections about poverty in the county. And what she described was both grim and hopeful, the way so many of our societal issues can be. But something she said really stuck with me, maybe because I was in the middle of writing this sermon. She reminded this group of us, about 40 people from 10 or 12 congregations, that no one person can have as much impact as inspired, creative, passionate community members can have together. I know that sometimes the work we do seems fruitless. Sometimes it feels like no one can see the difference that we're making. But remember that people with good social interaction live longer lives, and people who attend worship services have better health. We understand then that together we have power, and we can get things done, and we can make a change. Maybe that's why healing is important, because healed people are able to come back to the community, and because the community is always stronger than the individual. It's interesting to me in this story from Mark, and in so many stories like it, that Jesus doesn't stick around to enjoy the fruits of his labor. He doesn't stay put and establish a center for healing. He doesn't become the Dr. Feelgood of Galilee. He moves on. But the community that was there before Jesus arrived is still there after he leaves, and they experience healing and take that work on themselves. I want to give the benefit of the doubt to communities and say that most know the right thing to do, and I hope that's true for churches and for our congregation. We have received so much from God, so many blessings, so much help, so much healing, that we take on that work ourselves, sometimes without even being asked. It's natural to us. And we stay with this community, not because we'll live longer or happier or healthier lives, but because this is our place, our people, our tribe. It's where we will be our best selves, and when we are our worst selves, it's where we will be forgiven. It's where here that we'll do good work, not for ourselves, but for God and for other people. This last week, I heard a wonderful prose poem by Brian Doyle, and I think he captured what I've been trying to say. So I will give Mr. Doyle, may he rest in peace, the last word. A cold snap this morning, frost on the cars, and I remembered that merchant in Chicago who, when it got to be 20 degrees or so, would silently send out a boy with blankets for the guys huddled in the alleys for maybe a two-block radius. I saw this happen. What struck me powerfully was that the kid didn't even ask. The boss just nodded, and away he went, the kid with the blankets. The kid told me later he collected the blankets back when the temperature went back up over freezing. Once a year, the dry cleaner around the block washed the blankets for nothing. Things like this just seem to be everything. There's a lot of stuff like this. There is more stuff like this than anyone could ever measure. Maybe that is another reason why we need God to keep track. Amen.